Double Take. Critical, sometimes confrontational, but always amusing conversations about movies. Double Take is a Cinema Classics podcast presented by John DeSando.
I'm John DeSando.
And I'm KG Klein.
And this is Double Take. It's called The Whale.
What a way to end the year. My goodness. The last movie that I saw this year, and had to go a little out of our way to see it, but it was well worth it.
Yeah.
I'm going to sum up this movie with just two words. Powerful and disturbing.
Oh, yeah. And I agree with you completely. And I'm going to add my own take to this, all right? I am going to say, for Brendan Fraser, yes, for Golden Globes, yes, for Oscar.
I would agree. I would jump ahead to the Oscars right now and say it's a battle right now between Colin Farrell from Banshees of Inisherin, who gave a wonderful performance.
And he was my number one up until...
And mine, too. And a lot of critics have been saying that he was number one, but now, Brendan,
I don't know how they could...
I don't know how you can best Brendan Fraser in this movie.
I mean, I saw in Fraser's intonations and in his facial expressions... what I had never seen before with him, but I guess I can't remember back to The Mummy. And
Who would have thought that the person that was the action hero of The Mummy series 20 years ago would become a performer able to pull a role like this off?
Do you remember at all Gods and Monsters and whether he had a significant performance in that?
He gave a good performance in it, but it's nothing that would be any different than Harrison Ford or Larry Clavel would do. This is a performance that rises well above what you'd expect from somebody with a history of doing action movies.
Okay, this is my kind of movie, of course, which is not everybody's. The closer that it resembles a stage play, the happier I am. And this, you say, but John, this is cinema. I say, I realize that. But in the end, I'm always a word man.
Oh, well, then this is the perfect movie for you and anyone else who really enjoys adapted plays.
Yes. And would this be called an adapted play?
Well, there are two ways in which you can film a play. One, in the more common by far, is called the adapted screenplay, where basically you take the play and you turn it into a movie script. You add locations, you take the settings to different places, and it looks more like a movie. And that's the more common. Good examples of that are Inherit the Wind and The Apartment with Jack Lemmon. Great scripts, but they're taken from a play and then expanded. The other way is much rarer, and that's where you basically just film the play. You add a fourth wall to the set. Mm-hmm. You allow the camera to move around inside that little set, but it's basically just the set from the play.
I wonder if Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Go outside once maybe or so?
And this is a movie that is very reminiscent of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in its impact, in the power of its words, in the confrontation.
Yes.
You know, if you go to see The Whale or you watch this on streaming, be prepared. Be prepared for something like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or a movie that's going to have the emotional impact of Schindler's List, because this movie is just gut-wrenching. This is not a date night movie.
And regardless of what some very smart people are calling it exploitive, that they're exploiting the fat syndrome and even maybe making fun of it, it's not true.
Not at all. And the reason I would say that is because this play, when the playwright Samuel Hunter wrote it in 2012, is semi-autobiographical. Mm-hmm. Hunter was raised in rural Idaho, which is where the movie is set and the play. And
he moved from Iowa to Idaho, wasn't there some point in the film where his daughter says,
"Yes, yes, yeah." The missionary to Idaho. Yeah.
Is that an upgrade?
Is that better?
Although my daughter lives in Sun Valley.
Oh well,
which is not really Idaho.
No,
it's really heaven.
Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. But Samuel Hunter grew up. He was raised in a fundamentalist Christian church and went to school there, and he was a closeted gay man. And he developed self-loathing based on his experiences, and he turned to he self-medicated through food.
Yeah.
And he became quite heavy, and then he went on, and his job there was as a college freshman English teacher.
Yeah.
So everything about Charlie's character is really coming from his personal experiences.
And what's so interesting is that he teaches online. He
yes.
teaches in a Zoom fashion. And he will not show himself to his students. He claims his machinery is not functional.
Yeah.
But he actually doesn't want them to see how grotesque he is.
And when his daughter asks him, you know, what do you do about your camera? He says, I tell them it's broken. And she says, well, that's probably a good idea.
It is. So basically we have a story of a man who has grown obese, morbidly obese.
They call it morbidly obese.
Yeah.
And that's where it's no longer a complication. It's now a disease in and of itself. And it's very likely going to be the cause of death.
And one of the interesting parts of this play is there are reasons for this happening. It is not. In some cases, when I see people who are way overweight, it may be physiological.
Right.
Maybe they can't help it. Genetic. However you call it. There are reasons here in this play which are disclosed. And I love that part of it. That's the intricacy of it. It's not just an exploit.
Yeah, Hunter and Arnowski let us know that this was a choice that Charlie made. It had occurred over a period of time, but it was a choice, a decision that he made to allow himself to become this person.
And even as many movies as I've seen, Ken, I really turn away when I see him downing all that pizza and the mayo.
Oh.
And it's meant to disgust me, and it really does. And
this was a movie, and I do this sometimes, where I paid attention to the audience from time to time as I was watching the film. And I wanted to see what the audience's reactions were, because when you do see the character Charlie in full figure, he's probably about 500 to 550 pounds.
Supposedly around 600.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's a couple times when you see him full figure, or you see him with his shirt off, and you could hear the audience members around me going, oh, my God. And that is powerful.
Yeah.
That when you can elicit a reaction, like a verbal reaction from the audience, you don't get that from very many films.
And the advantage of this being a film is that you not only have a fat suit that you can somewhat manipulate for a camera, but also CGI, which can be layered on top of that to give you a sense of reality.
And that gives it an edge over, I would believe, the plays.
Yes.
Where
yes.
the plays, they would just pad the actor with between 20 and 100 pounds of prosthetic or pillows or a variety of things. In this, they were able to use CGI to give a very convincing effect of this is what Charlie looks like. And Charlie is so filled with self-loathing, and that comes across, but he is so filled with love and optimism and hope for other people.
Yes, wow. Talking about visually, when he stands up, he looked like a giant polar bear to me. Did you see? I could not believe.
He looked like Jabba the Hutt to me.
That too. Yeah, but when that one point when he stands up, my jaw is going, wow.
Yeah.
Immense, like an immense bear.
And I think for anyone who has known someone who is this size or has been worked with somebody who is morbidly obese, they will identify with a lot of the things that we see Charlie going through. He can't pick things up off the floor. He has to use a little device that grips things. When he sits down, he plops straight down from a standing position.
I thought he would break that wheelchair.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he would, but not. It was a wheelchair made for somebody very wide.
All of his furniture has to be built to endure that kind of weight and that kind of weight hitting it with a drop.
And we are not going to be smothered by this character because there are other very favorable characters.
Yes,
my favorite, of course, is his daughter Ellie, played by Sadie Sink.
Sadie Sink
from Stranger Things.
From Stranger Things, a favorite show of mine, and she showed up in the second season, and she is absolutely wonderful on that show, and she's wonderful in this movie.
She's my kind of lady. I mean, she's full of spark. And she's acerbic, and there's not a moment when she isn't.
And her character is the kind of character an actor loves, because she is very, very direct. She's very forceful, but there's a lot of subtlety to her character, and there's a lot of subtext to what's going on in her mind that she has to bring out.
So right, I mean, she's ostensibly misanthropic. There is nobody on this stage that can get away from her lightning bolt of sarcasm.
And the best scenes in this film is when Charlie and she are together. And Charlie is so filled with love and hope and optimism, especially for his daughter, because there's nothing left in his life.
Yes.
And she is so negative and so mean.
You know, picking up on what you said, there is subtlety to hers. There's a point at which I thought she was over the top in far as this teenage angst.
A little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think she could have been... Aronofsky could have directed her to tamp that down a bit.
He could have reeled it in, and he could have also showed another side to her a little earlier in the film.
Very good, yes.
That there is something there under the facade.
We've been to theater enough to know that is coming.
Yeah.
But it didn't come early enough.
It didn't come soon enough, and it didn't come enough. Yeah. She stays mean a little too long.
Yeah, yeah. This discussion is reminding me of the other good characters in here.
Oh, yeah.
Even down to the pizza delivery man.
A cast of six, yes, not counting the bird. There are only six people. And I imagine the stage play is a cast of five because you could double somebody to play the delivery man.
Right,
I don't believe he's seen
the
play.
Love the way they have the shadow go across the windows.
Yes.
People who are coming and going.
Yes.
These are like shadows in his life. What a great visual effect.
And this is such a small claustrophobic set.
Yes.
With this immense individual in it who just his size, if anything, seems even bigger when the set is so small.
Ken, this guy Aronofsky, what should I know about him?
Well, he's got two very famous films. He's made quite a few films, usually with a wide interval, 3-4 years between films. His last movie was a movie with Jennifer Hudson called Mother.
Oh, you know, and I liked it, but I don't know many people who liked it at all.
With Jennifer Lawrence, yeah.
Yes.
And I loved the movie.
I did too.
I absolutely, you're right. Most critics I know absolutely hated this movie. I love the movie because I got it. Right from the very start, I'm like, oh, he's doing the Bible, but he's doing the Bible in a very unconventional way through the lives of just two individuals. And I've seen the movie twice.
But his most famous movie
is Black Swan.
Yes.
Yes.
Oscar winner for his lead actress, right?
It was. Oh my gosh!
I knew that
was coming. But yes, it was. That's a fantastic film. A bit more mainstream than most of his movies. So it is the one that he's best known for. It had the widest release.
Yes, and there's another that I should know.
Oh, he's got 3 or 4 films before Black Swan.
Okay, yeah.
But he's a very unconventional director. And it's interesting that he would choose a script from a play because he usually writes his own movies or he usually widely adapts it. Like Black Swan is very much widely changed.
Mm-hmm.
But for Whale, something about Whale must have just really triggered a reaction with him, and he almost leaves the script untouched.
Okay. So I'm not going to catch you on this one, I know. I think we ignored what I thought one of the most brilliant supporting actress roles that I've seen.
And then
what do you know? I've seen her in another one this year. And I'm talking about Hong Chau as Liz.
Yes.
And she was also in the Triangle of Sadness.
Triangle of Sadness, yes.
And she played another pesky Asian who rises to lead.
The survivor who makes it to the end and then takes over the island.
I think the Columbus Critics Association, of which I belong, may have her as the best actress of the year for more than one role.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I
think both of those
that.
Although somewhat similar roles. I mean, she plays the crusty but loving nurse friend in Whale.
A difficult character, too, because her motivations are unclear for much in the movie. And it's only, and we don't want it to spoil any endings or any go into the second act.
Good for you.
But she's a very interesting character, and she has a difficult role in this.
Yeah. I'll tell you another difficult role. But I like her as I've always liked her. And you know who I'm talking about, Samantha Morton.
Oh, yes.
As Mary.
As Mary.
Wow. I mean, she's the ex-wife.
Yeah. And she shows up late in the film, and what a powerhouse.
Yes.
What a powerful, powerful performance. And when I was referencing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I'm really talking about the moment when the ex-wife shows up.
Uh-huh.
That's when this play, when this movie takes that Tennessee Williams turn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as she discloses, only a fine actress can do, a warm interior relative to him. You're thinking, well, nobody could love this guy. He even says, who would want to be in my life? You know, and she, at some point, she did want to. And I got a feeling that she might even have wanted him back in her life. At this some point, do you feel that?
Well,
same?
The thing that we get in this movie is that the happiest times for all of these characters are behind them. And that's such a difficult thing to accept. Charlie has not only accepted it, he's embraced it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, his wife, Mary, is not embracing it. She is struggling. She's fighting back. She is lashing out. She is angry. And they go in opposite directions. But watching them slowly come together is such a beautiful thing.
If I could predict that maybe this film will win Best Ensemble for the Columbus Critics Association.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Because there's another character we haven't talked about.
And we haven't talked about the missionary.
Yes, Thomas.
Thomas.
Ty Simpkins, I think is his name, the actor's name. How wonderful, he looks like he's straight off of that show, the Mormon show.
You know, your Book of Mormon?
Right, yeah.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Well, he doesn't sing and he doesn't dance, but he does carry the part beautifully.
Oh, I actually, when you were talking about the interaction between her and other characters, this one is right up there with her interaction with both her father and her mother. She actually deals with him in a way that's one of the light moments of the play when she maneuvers him around.
And he is such a crucial part to telling the story. At first, you might wonder, what is this kid even doing in this play? Well, what he does is he introduces the issue of religion to the story.
Mm-hmm.
He is he's a missionary. We're told he's from a fundamentalist church there in Idaho. He's coming to try to convert Charlie, and he creates this conflict because the more we learn about Charlie's former boyfriend, the more we find out how much religion has played a role in Charlie's life, and it is through this missionary character that's all set in motion.
Yeah, because there is a cult of sorts that they belong to.
There is a cult of sorts, and this goes back to Samuel Hunter. Again, he was raised in rural Idaho in a fundamentalist Christian school, and he was a closeted gay man, and he developed many issues as a result of that, which he explores with the whale. So the whale is such a deeply personal piece to him as much as the story is deeply personal to the characters within the film.
And I think in the case of Thomas, initially he looks like a stereotype.
Yes.
We've all seen him at our door selling Bibles.
Yes.
Okay, so we know it. So they take Aronofsky takes us and Hunter takes us from that moment to a much more complex character. And isn't the revelation just wonderful? I mean, get to that moment and you say,
yes, there's every character in this movie, there's more to them than you can see.
Yes.
There's a backstory to every one of them.
Yes.
And we explore Timothy's backstory a little later in the film, and it's a gut punch.
Oh, yeah, it's great. And I just love the way Aronofsky, which is what a brilliant director can do, gently brings that in without saying, well, I knew that was going to happen. I didn't say that at all,
no,
really.
No.
I thought he was
There's no moment in this movie when you want to get up and use the restroom. The play is a one act. There's no intermission, and it builds on its tension just as the movie does. The movie builds and builds and builds. The tension gets greater and greater until that claustrophobic environment just feels like it's overwhelming you, but you can't turn away.
No. So, well, we can't talk about the end.
No, we can't talk about the end.
We can't talk about the end.
The most we can say is the ending is slightly different from the play. However, Samuel Hunter has seen the film, and he loves the way the ending is handled. If it's a
some will object to that.
Yeah, some will object to it. It's a little bit more complete ending in the movie than in the play. It is less ambiguous than the
okay.
play is.
Oh, okay. We are told throughout that he's going to die. Yeah, I mean, at least his condition is predicted on the fact that he will die soon. This doesn't mean it happens at the end of the film.
It doesn't.
It's just it is hanging over everything.
Well, anytime a movie opens with the word Monday, and then 15 minutes later it's Tuesday,
yes.
you know you're on a countdown. The clock is ticking, and you're going somewhere, and it's going to happen fast. And plays have to be that way because you're having to condense all of your story into something that happens over a relatively short period of time. It becomes a little artificial and a little forced that so much of one person's life could occur within this 1 week. But if you're willing to give that, then it works beautifully.
And please, that is my advice too on any. When people have difficulty with that kind of thing you're talking about, I say, look, go with the playwright.
Yes.
Go with the director. Go where they want you to go. And what you can do it later is say, well, no, they didn't do it well. Or you could say they did it well. But don't try to redirect the play to your expectations.
A play cannot age a character 20 years during a two-hour performance. There's things that plays can do and things that plays can't do. And you have to work within that.
Yeah.
And then when you make a movie about that, you just have to understand that, give it a chance.
Yes. Now, K.G. Klein, the movie is The Whale. It is now is currently out. I have predicted Brendan Fraser will win both the Golden Globe and the Oscar. Okay? I could be wrong. I've been wrong many times in my life. But I rarely come out this early with something that I believe, like... Tar, like her role.
Cate Blanchett,
yeah. Like, those two, if they happen to ask me back on TV to predict, I'll open up with these, because these I feel so confident
there
about.
This is a wild year for the Oscars, if we want to jump that far ahead.
Yeah.
But the movies are out now, so we know what we're working with, finally. And there's only one lock this year. There is one lock. Even earlier on, I could have said this. And that's Pinocchio, Del Toro's Pinocchio, for Best Animated Film.
Oh, okay.
Nothing else running has got a fighting chance.
No
Red
film.
Red Panda didn't even get a theatrical release. There's a couple of anime movies. That's sort of how desperate
All right,
they
okay,
were.
Okay, yeah. okay. Here
but
we go.
But beyond that, yes. The other semi... lock would probably be Brendan Fraser. And unless Colin Farrell pulls a surprise, which is not impossible, Brendan Fraser is clearly the leader, because he certainly had so much handicaps that he was working with in this role. He was wearing 100 pounds of latex and prosthetics, which he had to work around. And any actor who's had to try to work in extensive prosthetics knows just how difficult that is. And in addition to that, a lot of his body was CGI during the course of the film, and he had to work with that as well. But he delivers just mostly through his facial, his expressions, his eyes. You're drawn into his eyes. He takes us from the moment we first meet him, we're requested to think he is disgusting. Aronofsky wants us to be disgusted by him from the very opening scene, and that's why he opens the movie the way he does.
But does that mean, Ken, you're bringing up the very question I was going to ask you. My friends, some of whom are very literate and very film literate, may not want to go to this because they believe it is disgusting. So I'm looking for your advice now. Here we have smart friends. What do we say to them to encourage them to go to this film?
This is what I would say to them. Did you watch The Elephant Man? Did you like The Elephant Man? Mm. If you like The Elephant Man, this is a retelling in some ways of The Elephant Man. Externally, he is disgusting. He knows he's disgusting. He's made himself disgusting. But you're asked to look inside. And you're also asked to do the same thing with the other actors, because the other characters are all disgusting in their own ways as well. Maybe not physically, but in other ways. Yes. They each have things about them that are disgusting. And then you're asked to look beyond that. And this is what this play and what Aronofsky does so brilliantly, is he takes you and makes you realize there's more to these people than just the physical appearance. Yes.
And I would end up by giving my advice to those friends of mine who love both theater and film and sometimes can't decide which they like better. Here's a combo.
This is easily the best adaptation of a play in theaters this year. No question. Nothing comes close.